Let me do it in the lower 48 states, since I don't want to impute to you that you necessarily have that same technology, although riding into the airport last night, I would be surprised if you did not. The technology of producing housing in the United States, in the lower 48 states, resides in men who have a range of skills, not just carpenters, bricklayers, and electricians, though obviously included, but also people called architects, engineers, attorneys, savings and loan officials, building code officials, all of those people whose skills are involved in the process of converting raw materials into finished spaces in which people live the private part of their lives that we call homes and in houses. The second element are institutions, organizations, societies, which employ skilled men, which provide for their training, which surround their activities. And those institutions in the case of home building would include not just labor unions and home builders, but savings and loan institutions, building code municipalities, or other municipalities, building code authorities, municipalities, schools which train new architects and engineers, etc. The third element that determines what a society can do technologically at any point in time are the resources available to that particular technological effort. And I mean by that not just financial resources. In the technology of housing, again, in the lower 48 states, we are dominated by one resource other than money, namely timber, wood, lumber. That's practically the only housing technology in the world in which that's still true. That has some interesting implications, because the next element in any technology, the fourth element, are the rules, regulations, and traditions which govern the relationship between men, institutions, and resources. And I don't know what your situation is here, because I haven't been able to find out, but we have lots of building codes in the United States with respect to housing that still say the walls of a house shall be 2x4s, 16 inches on center. That means timber. That only means timber, that means timber of a particular configuration. Not 2 inches by 4 inches, as it might sound, but 1 5/8 inches by 3 5/8 inches. Or it used to be, now the standard's going to be changed to 1.5 inches by 3 5/8 inches if it's dry lumber, and 1 5/16 inches by 3 5/8 inches if it's wet lumber. And if you think that's a minor issue, you should have been in the Department of Commerce with me. Because that issue, when it came before the Secretary of Commerce, has generated more correspondence than any issue that ever came before the Secretary of Commerce since the Department of Commerce was founded in 1903. That is, to change the size of a 2x4. And it still hasn't been resolved. 7 years we've been battling with it. There's another tie back from that, though, and that's at the men and institutions level. The skilled men who work with timber are called carpenters, and the carpenters belong to a union. And the jurisdictional prerogative of the carpenters union is very interesting. It says that carpenters are responsible for everything that is made of wood, or ever was made of wood. That last being added about 30 years ago, when we began to substitute metal windows for wooden windows, and metal doors for wooden doors, etc. So the domination of the technology of housing, in at least the lower 48 states, by that resource timber, affects the kinds of rules, the kinds of institutions, and the kinds of skilled men that are involved in the technology of housing. All right, now, that's technology, and that's the issue to which I want to return tomorrow with you, to face the question about what are some alternatives that Alaska might do with respect to the technology, not just of making housing, but of making the urban places in which you now live and will be living the balance of your lives. What is it that we make when we make an urban place? We make a city? Well, that's not so good. I gather there are places here that, interestingly enough, every school child knows by name, Juneau, Sitka, Nome, that are hardly cities by conventional definition of a city. But it's an urban place, a town, a place where people live together. There are a lot of debate in so-called city planners about what a city is for this purpose. There are some people, like Mel Weber, that sometimes speaks before John, who argue that the city as a notion is obsolete, that the boundaries of an urban place as determined politically, and saying this is the city and what lies beyond that magic boundary is not the city, is a false notion. And I think that's reasonable, because if one looks at St. Louis, Missouri, and East St. Louis, Illinois, or Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, we find that not only does that urban place not stop at the borders of what's known as Kansas City, Kansas, it doesn't stop at the border of the state, that the urban place somehow or other is larger than whatever the political boundaries are. There's also another kind of notion about what a city is, that in some ways your towns and cities, to me, as a, I don't even know what the word is, the guy who came from the other side of the tracks, from the lower 48, that your cities have always had. And that's an image that we carry in our hearts that doesn't represent necessarily reality at all. If we sing a song like Chicago, Chicago, that wonderful town, or I left my heart in San Francisco, we don't really mean a dirty collection of buildings that we find when we get there, but we mean some sort of style of life that we think is there, or will be there when we get there, or that we once experienced when we were there. And it's that image that we carry in our hearts that represents San Francisco to many people as a mecca that they think they would like to go to. We've lost that in an awful lot of our cities in the lower 48, except for one funny kind of an institution that still preserves it, namely sports teams. That word, like the Dallas Cowboys, Baltimore Colts, but somehow or other the city's image is preserved by the football team, or the baseball team, or the hockey team that it has. And I can remember when I was a boy, which I don't like to think was so long ago, but there was still something called radio in the lower 48 states, there was an amateur hour called Major Bowes Amateur Hour. And when an amateur would come on, Major Bowes would always ask him from what city he came. And if he said he was from Brooklyn, there was always wild cheering, and stamping with feet and whistling. Not because I think very many people have ever been in a godforsaken place called Brooklyn, that my father was born in, but because the Brooklyn Dodgers were a popular team. And the image that people had in their minds and carried in their hearts about what Brooklyn was the image of the Brooklyn Dodgers, those real players. Well, I think there are images that people have in the lower 48, most of them favorable, by the way, about what words like Anchorage and Fairbanks and Nome mean. And I wonder if you really try to build when you talk about urban planning or dealing with the technology of future cities, would you really take those into consideration? If we talk about the technology of making urban places, then, I would argue that it's not necessarily important that we try to define where the boundary of that place is. And that for the purposes of our discussion today and tomorrow, that those boundaries can be the boundaries of your state. That the boundaries are not the boundaries of the city of Anchorage, or even of the borough in which Anchorage resides, but of a state. And the image that I get for talking about cities, which is one that comes from the analogy of a living organism, can be imagined by you very easily in your mind's eye if you think of getting up above Alaska far enough. I suppose you'd have to be an astronaut, it would be technically possible to do so, so that you could see the whole of the state and could pick out pieces of it by zeroing in with a more focused lens. And it would look like something that was alive, particularly at night. You approach a city like Anchorage from the air at night and look at it from 10,000 feet. It looks not unlike a living organism does through a microscope in a laboratory. And you can see its veins and arteries. And you can see life going on as things blink on and off. And as you get closer to it, you can even see the hollow places of its cells in which life is going on. So that the analogy of speaking of the city, as I want to try to do with you, on the basis of it being some large organism, I think holds within that image. The image of the city, then, that I want to speak of is one that's based on that analogy, plus a more complex notion. I think it's not so complex, but I find it's complex sometimes to explain, but let me try to do it. I want to differentiate between the hardware systems and the software systems of the city. Now, those words are borrowed from the world of the computer. Many of you who work with computer are familiar with those terms, but I'll assume that most of you aren't. What we mean by hardware in that context is the thing that's manufactured, the visible instrument, our collection of instruments, which have lights blinking on and off, and wheels rolling around, electricity coursing through its veins, which you can kick and touch and see and smell and feel, the object which is manufactured. That's the hardware. That's the visible part. The software is invisible. It's a way of using the hardware. It's a mathematical language. It's a logic about how the internal workings of the computer are structured. And I would argue, or if I don't want to argue, I want to present to you the notion that there are hardware systems and software systems in the city. Software systems, those invisible systems, for example, go by such titles as healthcare systems, education systems, commercial systems, systems of justice. You can't see a justice system, and you can't really see an education system. Those are ways of using hardware. What you can see are the things that we make: school buildings, buses, textbooks, desks, and the people who operate within them, school children and school teachers. The hardware, then, the hardware notions that I want to talk about, are those things which we make that are the physical manifestation of our urban places. Remembering that there are software systems, like educational systems, healthcare systems, systems of justice, which depend on and utilize those hardware systems. And the important argument that I want to make, which is not an easy one again, is that there is a dependency between the performance capabilities of the hardware systems and what it's possible to do with the software systems. And most people that I know, including some conversations I've heard here in the last few days, who are concerned about healthcare systems and education systems and systems of justice, assume implicitly that the hardware isn't going to change. We may have more schools like the schools we've got, or we may have bigger ones, or we may have more textbooks, or we may have a new hospital, but the performance capability of that thing which is going to be made, of the hardware which makes up the city, is assumed that it will be the same indefinitely into the future, and so the real problem to work on is the software problem. What can we do about changing the role of teacher and student to one another, or the educational content of their education, the invisible part of it, assuming the hardware will be at least what we have now, or maybe we'll get some new stuff just like it? I want to argue that that's a limited and short-sighted view, that in fact, it would be possible to increase the performance capability to change the very nature of what the hardware systems were, and by doing that to alter the nature of what would be possible to do software-wise. In fact, some of the software problems would disappear. Let me use a simple illustration. If 100 years ago we had had a meeting like this, not in Alaska, let's say, but in Buffalo, New York, and we were concerned about healthcare systems in the city, we might have argued that part of our strategy for dealing with what was then a recurring phenomenon of cities, namely epidemics, would be to try to deal with the problem of epidemics by inventorying and stocking supplies of drugs in various places around the city, to get more physicians trained in dealing with epidemiology, with the phenomenon of epidemics, to have them available, to beef up the public health service, to train more doctors, etc. Assuming that there wasn't going to be any change in the hardware systems of our cities. What in fact happened within the next 30 years was that plumbing was discovered, invented, reduced to practice. And that instead of outhouses behind people's houses for disposing of human waste, that hydraulic systems based on reservoirs, water, sewers, and toilets were put into houses. And that had more impact on reducing the possibility of epidemics occurring within cities than any of the other inventions that we would have been dealing with at that time if we had assumed that the hardware would not change. So what looks like now in hindsight has been a simple decision, which obviously was not at the time, namely to bring human waste disposal from the outhouse in the backyard into the building, and to make the investment as a society in the infrastructure of reservoirs, water distribution systems, sewer systems, sewage disposal plants, in order that people could privately make decisions about buying toilets and bathtubs and wash basins, that had a major impact on the healthcare system of cities. We haven't exhausted. We haven't begun to exhaust the possibilities of what we could do to improve the hardware of our cities. We just absolutely are not working here. I don't know one major corporation in the United States that's looking at how to advance the hardware capability of our urban context. They want to build better things like the ones we already have. And with one exception, possibly, the area of pollution, there are some hardware experiments being performed, but they're relatively minor. There is a dependency, therefore, I hope we begin to believe, between the hardware systems and the software systems of the city. And to understand this dependency, I would argue, the systems approach, to take a systems view, is not only useful, but necessary. And I would present to you the possibility that the systems view, appropriately used as an intellectual tool, obviates the necessity for a lot of arguments that I've been hearing here in the last day or so. Namely, that why don't we put somebody administratively in a position in an organization of the state government to deal with that issue? I think that's a mythical type of solution, because we don't really understand very well yet the intellectual tool of the systems approach. What we recognize is the dependency between a lot of the decisions that get made in our man-made environment and our natural environment. And we recognize that the fractionation of dealing with them by one department, one at a time, probably doesn't represent a comprehensive view of their systematic relationships and dependencies. So our simplistic observation of how to solve that dilemma is to make a czar who's responsible for all of those things, and that somehow or other that czar having been appointed, the organization will now come neatly into order, and we will have these questions dealt with. Unless that czar brings with him the tools of intellectual tools of systems analysis, I doubt that that will be true. And if the intellectual tools of systems analysis are available to the legislative and executive branch of the government, I don't think we need the czar. Because we won't begin to make decisions about new highways until we think through the systematic impact which alternative transportation systems are going to have on the other hardware systems of our urban context and the software potential which will exist as a result until we've thought that through systematically. That's not easy to do. I don't want to kid you. If you begin to look at the ramifications of the thousands and tens of thousands of variables that have to be dealt with, then recognizing the systematic dependency of the various systems in the urban context and to try to evaluate the impact of one upon the other, you're dealing with a very complicated problem. I want to talk about tomorrow some of the ways in which I think it's possible to begin to deal with that kind of intellectual problem. If we want to take a look, then, at the hardware systems of our urban places, I would argue that we can begin to understand their interdependency by looking at it with this analogy of a living organism. I'm going to talk about four systems. The cardiovascular, I'll explain what I mean by these in a second, let me get the words out. The cardiovascular system, the nervous system, the metabolic system, and the enclosure system, the skin and skeleton. That's how my body's made up, that's how your body's made up. Those systems have a dependency in your body which are relatively clear to you. If they're not clear to you, at least clear in the medical profession. If we look at our urban context, the man-made hardware in our urban environment, I believe that they have these kinds of dependencies, the same kinds of dependencies and interrelationships. And let me elaborate on that. The cardiovascular system, there are those systems which make movement possible. And I want to use movement instead of transportation. In order to get from here to there, whether it's Nome to Anchorage, or whether it's this building over to my hotel, some hardware system has to be available to either facilitate my movement on foot, to move me, or to move my message, if that's all I want to convey, from here to there. In order for movement to occur, some sort of hardware process is necessary. That's the cardiovascular system. And in a state like Alaska, that becomes very attenuated, because there are lots of small clusters, nuclei of life which is going on, which are connected by these cardiovascular networks. And existing solutions happen to be things like roads, highways, the vehicles which move along them, railroads, airplanes, and airports. Also are things like elevators, and escalators, and sidewalks. Did you have a problem using that movement system today the way I did? You've got a little key device on it. There's an easy performance requirement to change the hardware capability of one very elementary system. The movement system that makes it possible for me to get around on my feet in Anchorage is called a sidewalk. I would think, for Christ's sake, in a city like Anchorage, that one would have assumed that once in a while there would be something like snow or ice. So a performance requirement to improve the hardware of that thing called sidewalk at the elementary level, is that it works under all kinds of weather conditions. That's not a very great invention. I don't know anybody's working on it. Movement systems, therefore, I would classify into three categories. Those systems which make movement on foot possible. When I leave here and I want to go get dinner later, I got to get from here to there. And I'm going to walk up and down stairways, and I'm going to go on elevators, and I'm going to walk on sidewalks and through hallways. It doesn't look that systematically, but it is a system. And then there are transporting systems, and that's mostly what we think about when we talk about the urban context. But those transporting systems happen to be the solutions that we have right now. And God didn't say in Genesis that there shall be airplanes, motorboats, automobiles, and railroads, and that ain't all, and that's always going to ever be. Well, that just happens to be the limits of our imagination at the moment. I don't know very many people who are working on alternative transportation systems. Faster trains, yeah. Bigger airplanes, wider highways, the whole new modes of movement, transporting movements, there's some. That happens to be one area in which there's some work going on. But the third area of movement systems, are movement conduits. And you're about to make a huge investment in one of those, the pipeline. But that's part of the movement system, too. It wouldn't be called transportation, and that's the reason I don't want to use the word transportation. But it's certainly part of the cardiovascular network that's going to make Anchorage tick, make Alaska tick. So there are all kinds of conduits, gutters, sewer pipes, wires, pipelines, etc. They look a lot like the cardiovascular systems in the body, don't they? Whether we intended it or not, we try to pretend to use that analogy. When we talk about arterial highways, don't we? And some of the diseases we have with respect to the transportation in densely populated places have all the impacts of being like arteriosclerosis. Because it's at the strictures, the bridges and the tunnels where the blood clots start forming. If the blood clots start forming on a bridge, movement stops. Rigor mortis can set in if it gets to be bad enough. And some people think it's very possible that New York City's going to have that kind of heart attack one of these days from which it won't recover. The second system, the nervous system, is the information communications network that, like the organism that we are, makes it possible for the various parts to keep in touch. That makes it possible for somebody to try to use the urban context. Or that makes it possible for somebody to try to manage it. The present solutions include things like the telephone system. Interestingly enough, that's probably the most sophisticated and best working system, at least in the lower 48, of any of our urban systems. And I would argue that that's because it has always been called the Bell Telephone System, and because the Bell Telephone Laboratories have addressed the problem of improving the telephone service not as an instrument, but as a system. In which, in fact, they have automated that system and put people out of work. You know, terrible social consciousness on their part. When I was a boy, growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, I could pick up the telephone, and a nice voice would say, "Number, please." And I would say, "Give me such and such a number, and I didn't have to do any more work." When my wife was a little girl, she lived in a very small town, Redbud, Illinois, she'd pick up and she'd say, "Operator, give me my mommy." The operator connected her to her mommy, whether she was over, you know, having coffee in somebody's house. That's pretty nice service. But if all the telephones now in operation in the United States depended on the technology of that nice operator, Every woman between 25 years old and 40 years old in the United States would have to be employed as a telephone operator. That nasty old Bell telephone system developed solid-state electronic circuitry for switching devices and put them out of work. But my wife didn't want to be a telephone operator, and my daughter wasn't want to be a telephone operator, so they don't mind at all when automation put them out of work. A part of this nervous system of the state of Alaska, or of any urban context, has to do with something that once again isn't very systematically looked at. And something which seems to me that perhaps you, of all people, ought to be looking at now, namely, how does somebody who comes into that context for the first time get information about how to use it? I came in from the airport last night with a cab driver who said he just arrived here from Texas 2 days ago. He didn't have any idea where anything was, except, fortunately for me, the Captain Cook Hotel. Two other people who were there, who were old-timers here in Anchorage, knew where they were going so they could tell him how to find his way. But he didn't know how to find his way. He presumably is getting paid for that. How about the guy who comes here who wants to use this, you know, just this nucleus of the urban context called Anchorage? What kind of information system have you got for him? Well, I see street signs. That's better than some cities have. You know, in Boston, I only put street signs on the streets that intersect the main thoroughfares because they assume everybody in his right mind knows what street he's on. It's the one he has to be coming in contact with he needs to know about. I don't know what your street numbering system is. Well, one of the old timers in the cab driver last night, I'll be glad it's the way it is now, the way it was 10 years ago. Because every new suburban area was developed 10 years ago and named the streets the same as the other suburban areas. And just to know what the name of the street was wasn't good enough. You had to know what suburban area it was in. Well, it sounds like you've been working on that a little bit. But have you ever tried, have you ever been to New York City and tried to walk from 105 Park Avenue over to 105 Madison Avenue or Fifth Avenue? That numbering system in Manhattan doesn't mean a thing. If you're one block on Fifth Avenue, it's got no relationship to Sixth Avenue or Park Avenue. Does it in Anchorage? Does it in Nome? I made an experiment in New York City one time. I walked out of a hotel and I said, I'm going to find out what kind of information the environment of New York City provides me to get from my hotel to Grand Central Station. The Pennsylvania Station, because I had a ticket envelope like that in my pocket that said the Pennsylvania Railroad. Reasonable assumption, the Pennsylvania Railroad operates out of Penn Station, right? Okay, that's first mistake, well, I didn't know that. I wasn't going to use a cab because that's supposedly cheating. Most cab drivers know where they're going anyway. I was going to find out what I could find out from the environment. Well, my hotel was on 57th Street, and I knew the Grand Central from Penn Station was on 34th Street. But one of the things I had going for me was if I walked from 57th to 56th, I could depend on the next one being 55th. Because there was an arithmetic progression of the streets. That piece of information worked. Like I said, it was too far to walk. And I knew that those green holes in the ground, the stairs going down, had to do something with one of those cardiovascular networks called the subway. And I walked over to them, and what kind of information did I get? IRT, DMT. I've been going to New York a long time. I still don't know what that means. I don't even know what IRT stands for, much less whether if I walked down into that hole in the ground, it would get me to Pennsylvania Station. And I do know for a fact that if you walked down into that hole in the ground, there wasn't any map to tell you where you're going, so you got on the train and were going in the wrong direction. They're changing that now, but that was true up until 2 years ago. Well, anyway, I'm going to bowels of the earth anyway. And I knew there were things called buses. And I could hear my wife saying, why don't you ask somebody? Your wife do that to you? So, I did, you know, I knew it was going to happen probably anyway. The first guy I asked said he was from Des Moines, Iowa. He didn't know. The next guy I asked, I think, was crucial. He didn't speak English. And we really blamed Arabic in the United States. So we assumed that our information system should assume that you speak English. Especially in a city like New York, where there are thousands of people coming from all over the world every day. If you go to Europe and use their transportation network, as you may know, you don't need to speak English because your graphics will provide you with that information. Well, I gave up. Besides, there was some sign there that said bus. Here comes one of these Goliaths. So what kind of information did it have on it? They had an identification number, like 145, I don't know who that means anything to, maybe the bus driver and the starter, but doesn't mean anything to me, obviously. And then it had a magic words, like Gramercy Park, or the Battery. And if you really had the map of New York City stored in your head, that might help you, because you could assume that if it said Gramercy Park, that's the way it was going. I just had to take a chance. And after I got on the bus, the next thing I found out was that it didn't move in regular intervals, it moved in gulps. Those might be 6 blocks, or 3 blocks, or 1 block. And since I was going to 34th, I had to take a chance when I got within the range of 34th that I would get off. And I got off at 34th, and one of the things I had going for me as an architect was I knew what Pennsylvania Station looked like, with its tall columns and Corinthian order, etc. Fortunately for me, it hadn't all been torn down yet then. The facade was still standing, so I could recognize it. I walked down into Pennsylvania Station feeling like a last minute, whipped off my ticket, showed it to a man in uniform, another piece of information. He's a guy to ask, presumably. The man in uniform, he says, you're in the wrong station. That leads from Grand Central Station. Well, I don't know how many of you ever tried to get from Penn Station to Grand Central Station in New York City at 9 o'clock in the morning. He said it was easy. Just take the shuttle. And I said, where's the shuttle? And he says, just go that way. So I went that way. You walk into a white tiled tunnel, about 20 feet wide and 10 feet high, with masses of humanity, 16 abreast, charging through the tunnel, going somewhere. I'm tall enough, I could get information over their heads, like Dick Maddox's orange juice, and read the Wall Street Journal. Nothing about the shuttle. Till I walked at least a mile, and then I saw one of those signs again that said IRT, DMT. I said, I bet that's got something to do with the shuttle. I'll go over and ask the girl who sells the tokens. And I did. And there, as Harlow Guthrie says, was a handmade sign that this girl had made. Because so many people had gone that same path, that she said, if you want to take the shuttle, on this written sign, go downstairs and take the train to Times Square and change to the shuttle. A simple, goddamn piece of information in the system that if anybody had ever looked at the information system in New York City systematically to try to enable a stranger to use it, that would have been put into the system somewhere. Sounds a very tough task, I'm not sure. The third system, the metabolic system, and this is the most challenging, I think. I don't know any other word to substitute for it because we don't really have that connotation yet in the urban context. The metabolic system of the city is like the metabolic processes of the body. It provides the city with energy, it provides it with the protoplasm to restore its surfaces or to create new surfaces. And like the metabolic processes of the body, the city works in somewhat the same way. Huge quantities of input flow into it every day. Food, fuel, water, raw materials. And these are converted by the processes of the city. There are kidneys and livers. There are things like power plants, and generating systems, and supermarkets, and concrete mixing plants, in which the raw materials that flow in are converted to some useful purpose for creating energy for the city, or After creating the protoplasm, the things, the surfaces, the streets, the buildings are made of materials and they need to be patched or to be built. Those are made by some processes. And it's inevitable. It's just as inevitable as metabolic processes in the body, but the byproducts of those processes are waste. And we get all uptight these days, at least in the lower 48, about pollution. Of the air, the water, the land. And we mount large efforts to start working on pollution without looking at it as a systems problem very often. Mainly it begins with the inputs. Alaska could pass laws, if it wanted to, about what's going to cross the borders of the state in the form of inputs. If no aluminum cans ever came in, for example, that wouldn't pose a waste disposal problem for you. Most importantly, those processes which convert the inputs into energy and into protoplasm are not very often looked at, except if Chile got a smokestack that produces less smog in Los Angeles in order to reduce the smog in Los Angeles. Let me give you a simple illustration. My favorite subject when I talk to you about tomorrow's garbage. The character of garbage in the United States, the lower 48 at least, I suspect here, has changed dramatically in the last 15 years. 15 years ago, 80% of the content of garbage was organic matter, so it was possible to feed it to pigs and the hogs. Today, less than 10% of its organic matter, 80% of it is cellulose. The reason? That space valve called a supermarket, which has taken the raw materials of the foodstuffs that flow into the city and has packaged them, so that my wife and most other wives buy food in packages, which we totally consume within the home. And what we throw away is not organic material, but we throw away the packages in which that food came. We throw it away in very large quantities. That's changed the nature of garbage. Now, we didn't do it consciously or on purpose, but the creation of supermarkets changed the nature of garbage. That's beginning to take a systems view. When you say, what are the inputs that are coming into the city, and what are the processes that convert those inputs into usable forms of food energy in this case, and what can we do about those processes to change the nature of the waste that's going to be produced that we now call garbage? The fourth system of the city is what I call the enclosure system. The skin, the skeleton of the city that surrounds the hollow places in which life goes on, in which we live, work, worship, have meetings like this. And we try to talk about those mostly as buildings. They're not just buildings. They're playgrounds and prison walls and special places that we settle outside, like the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. But mostly they're designed by people, and they're designed at all, called architects, one at a time, for one client, on one piece of property. That's not very systematic again. In a system of producing things called houses, in which we live a private part of our lives, just as non-systematic in character. And I want to talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. It's the linking together, and I think I've at least begun to suggest to you ways that one can understand the complexity, the linking together of all of these hardware systems of the city, the cardiovascular networks, the nervous systems of the city, the metabolic processes of the city, and the enclosure systems that make up the urban complex which Alaska now has, and which you will be building in one way or another in the balance, you know, the next 10, 20, 30 years, for the rest of the time we exist. The ways of making those things are the technologies of building urban places. We aren't stuck with necessarily the technology that we now have. And tomorrow I want to talk to you about ways that I think alternatives could be looked at for Alaska in approaching those questions in the future. Now I want to close by reading a quotation that I think adds qualitatively to this issue something very important that perhaps hasn't come through in what I've been saying so far. This is a quotation from a review of a book of poetry by Archibald MacLeish, written by the historian Henry Steele Collinger. He says, rarely in history has a great nation at the height of its power and success so wasted its intellectual and moral resources as has the United States since 1949. That waste, that betrayal is writ large in the literature of our generation. Ours is not an absurd time, says Mr. MacLeish. It's a great and tragic time, which has produced some of the most remarkable figures the world has ever seen. It's the epoch in which man has gone farther out towards the unknown than he's gone in all the centuries before. Future generations, he says, will look upon these last few years as among the most terrible and splendid in the annals of the race. Why then have we peopled them with pettiness and squalor? And why, after our titanic achievements, do we find ourselves not only confused, but impotent intellectually and morally? Not only have we lost confidence in ourselves, dissipated our energies, dissolved our dreams, and substituted any principles for principles, and any policies for policies, but we've lost confidence in man himself. What a piece of work is man, and how noble in reason, and how infinite in faculties, said Hamlet. But not to us. To us, man is ignoble rather than noble, and limited in faculties. He's not the beauty of the world or the paragon, but petty, ineffective, and irrelevant. Mr. MacLeish can no more explain this loss than can others, this loss of nerve and loss of faith. He reminds us that the explanation is not to be found in the science that makes man insignificant, or in the loss of religious faith. We know nothing, we fear nothing that the Greeks did not know and fear. It's merely that we react differently to knowledge and terror. Our chief failure, says Mr. MacLeish, is a failure of the imagination. We know more than any previous generation, we probably feel less. It's our incapacity, our refusal to feel, to realize emotionally what we know intellectually, that's at the root of our trouble. If you can't approach the problem of how we're going to build a man-made environment with imagination, then that's not a function of policy. Thank you.